Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up is the 25-year-old congressional candidate Deja Fox, the future of the Democratic Party.
And another story of misbehaving as part of our Soapbox series.
But first, Arizona lawmakers approved their new state budget with just days to spare before the start of the new fiscal year. Just a few days later, President Trump signed the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, which includes many of his policy priorities. To pay for them, the federal measure also includes spending cuts to programs like Medicaid and SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Those two federal programs send money to the state, so cuts to them will mean less money coming to Arizona. With me to talk about what that might mean, especially in light of the spending plan approved by state lawmakers and the governor, is Glenn Farley, Director of Policy and Research with the Common Sense Institute in Arizona. And Glenn, let's start with a 30,000-foot takeaway from the Arizona budget. When you look at both policy and money changes, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, the first thing I guess I'll say is what a roller coaster ride to get to a conclusion that in many ways, if you've been following the state budget for the past couple of years, is a status quo budget. There isn't much different from prior budgets, but that's not to say it doesn't do a lot. It spends about $2 billion. Historically, we have not spent that much, but that has been the status quo of the past couple of cycles. We spent $2 billion two cycles ago. Then we couldn't spend. We actually had to make some reductions because there was no money left, and then we spent $2 billion again this year. So that's what I mean when I say status quo. The other interesting thing about this budget from my perspective is for that $2 billion, it's hard for me, or I think probably anyone else, the governor or the legislature or anyone else, to articulate what exactly we bought for that $2 billion.
How much of that, though, was sort of increases that were mandated by formulas? I mean, some of that, you know, there's more, maybe more people on access, more people, more kids in schools, things like that, that you have to pay for.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question and a fair point. And the short answer to that is about half. It's split roughly between $900 to $1 billion in so-called baseline issues. That's what you're sort of describing. These would be K-12 formula increases, Medicaid formula increases, et cetera. And then $1 billion in sort of new initiatives. That's sort of the budget parlance for new policy changes. But don't ignore too much that $1 billion in baseline increases. Those were all simply prior year policy changes. For example, a significant chunk of the increase in the K-12 space is general fund money to backfill the expiration of Proposition 123. We've been talking about the imminent expiration of Proposition 123 for years. It was effectively a policy decision by the legislature and the governor's office to punt on or allow Proposition 123 to expire, necessitating those funding increases. They needed not to have done that.
So when you look at what is in the budget, does it seem as though lawmakers and the governor left themselves wiggle room to deal with some of the uncertainty that at that time they weren't quite sure about what was coming from the federal government? Now we have maybe a little more certainty, but not total certainty. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's enough wiggle room that lawmakers and the governor aren't going to have to come back and mess with this too much?
That, too, is an interesting question. You know, I've worked on the state budget for many, many years, previously in the governor's budget office and more recently externally. And in my experience, there's never enough capacity left behind to really handle any significant movement in the state budget. But 2 years ago, legislators and the governor signed a budget that left effectively $0 in the general fund. Now, that necessitated a painful correction the immediately following fiscal year. I do think policymakers learned from that. So while this budget repeats the recent cycle of large spending increases, it does leave more money in cash in the general fund. I think the number is about $200 million at the end of the year. Again, going back to the last 2 years, we had a $1 billion roughly cash deficit, unexpected cash deficit. $200 million could not weather that, but that's atypical.
I want to ask you about the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, which President Trump signed on July 4th. Still, I mean, it's a huge, massive bill. it's going to take a long time to really understand what the implications are of it and what will change. But some of the big ticket items, changes to Medicaid, changes to the SNAP program, essentially what are often called food stamps, things like that. When you look at what might be coming down, trickling down to Arizona in terms of less federal money, maybe more people without health insurance, more people without coverage to help them buy food and groceries, things like that. What might that do to the state of Arizona's budget?
Yeah, great question. And as you alluded to, the bill is large and brand new, so I won't claim to be an expert, but I did just this morning actually start looking at some of the provisions. You know, as you know, there's been a lot of speculation about the implications of federal changes for the state budget going on for many, many months. And there's really three parts. You talked about two of them, but three parts of these federal proposed changes that potentially could impact the state budget and state policy. There's Medicaid, there's food stamps, and there's also tax codes. So there's a kind of the big three. And the big, beautiful bill touches all three of those things. So it's natural to assume it will have implications to ask what. So I'll start with the easy one. On the tax changes side, a lot of what it does is codifying and continuing the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act from 2017. The state largely already conforms to that, so that becomes baseline at that point. A lot of the new policy changes are below the line. That's just a technical term, but for your listeners, all they need to know is that means by default, the state won't have a conformity issue or a significant conformity issue, in my opinion, due to a big, beautiful bill. So that's the tax changes. Looking at Medicaid and food stamps, for sure there are reforms here. And the federal policymakers and the federal budget scorecard assumed those reforms would lower federal costs by reducing the number of folks using and the amount of services those folks were using on Medicaid and SNAP. That trickle down likely means, if it's true, that there will be fewer folks enrolled in the state's Medicaid program and fewer folks enrolled in the state's food stamp program over the next 10 years compared to the baseline. That produces some much smaller state general fund savings, but also reduces the flow of federal dollars into the state. But contextually, what we're talking about are relatively small reductions over 10 years and compared to a baseline that assumes growth.
Is there a danger? I mean, we've heard a lot about, for example, rural hospitals who are required by law to treat anybody who comes in. And just because somebody is no longer on Medicaid doesn't mean they're not going to get sick and need care. Might the state be in a position where, you know, a hospital in a rural part of the state is, which is already running on very tight margins, might be in danger of shutting down and the state has to step in and do something to prevent that from happening?
No, I think that is a fair point. You know, in general, the hospitals are more reliant than the overall average American healthcare system on Medicaid dollars, and the rural hospitals likely disproportionately even more so. So it could have implications for the state's rural hospital system. I think some of the proposed more substantive reforms that were talked about months ago, this was potentially a larger issue. Again, these, in the grand scheme of things, of the size of Medicaid and the amount of future expected growth, are likely to be relatively small. So do I think there will be dramatic implications for the state's rural hospital system as a whole? Probably not. Might there be independent, isolated hospitals that are already sort of operating on the margins where this could push them or tip them one way or the other? Absolutely, that's always sort of a risk.
Would you anticipate that state lawmakers will be looking at this federal bill and maybe taking things from it to incorporate, you know, policy-wise and try to incorporate in the state maybe next legislative session?
Absolutely. That, I think, is a much more realistic interpretation. So, again, circling back to the baseline implications for the state budget over the next 10 years, likely de minimis. I'm sure there will be provisions that will have baseline costs, but likely de minimis. But will there be policy debates and policy implications of these federal reforms? Absolutely. I wouldn't be surprised in the slightest if you saw some state lawmakers and legislators wanting to piggyback off of some of the federal tax reforms like overtime, tips, car loan interest deductions, and proposing to incorporate those into the state tax code. Those would have revenue implications, of course. And then correspondingly, this has been an ongoing debate since Arizona adopted Medicaid expansion. I suspect it will continue to be an ongoing debate, is how does the state fund its Medicaid and its food stamp populations? And how does it do so, especially now, given how much larger and more expensive those programs are than they were before the pandemic?
All right. That is Glenn Farley, Director of Policy and Research at the Common Sense Institute, Arizona. Glenn, thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Some advocates of career and technical education programs are up in arms about a potential move by the Trump administration to move the administration of the program out of the Department of Education and into the Department of Labor. Democrats in Congress insist the department doesn't have the power to make that kind of change, and advocates say it could worsen the job training programs and be the beginning of the end of DOE. Right now, the move is on hold because of a judge's injunction preventing the Trump administration from dismantling the Education Department. But our next guest says he doesn't think this spells all doom and gloom for career and technical education, or CTE. Chad Wilson is the superintendent of the East Valley Institute of Technology, or EVIT. He came into our studios recently to talk more about it, beginning with how he thinks this move might impact his program.
That's a fair question. And I'll be honest, I think it is an ever-evolving situation. So to completely understand it is a bit problematic. But my limited understanding is that the idea of moving CTE out of the Department of Education into the Department of Labor could carry with it some ramifications as it relates to Carl Perkins and other federal funding, in that those federal funding sources appear to be, from my understanding, linked to the Department of Education. And so if you move CTE out of the DOE and to the DOL, will that limit the ability to have access to those funds? And
okay.
So that's a real concern. I think that is a legitimate concern. I don't know that necessarily it's a deal breaker, but I think it's a concern that folks need to have and should be aware of.
Yeah. Okay. So when you're talking about career and technical education, right, like what does that mean exactly? Like it's moved beyond, I understand, in recent decades, the kind of old school model where you'd sort of say some students are going to become electricians and some students are going to go to college. Like there's much more to it now.
There is. And I think that is such a smart question to ask, because I think it's that's the question that I think sometimes still stumbles us. My son went to high school here in the East Valley. And when he was a freshman in high school, we went to his counselor and we said to his counselor, we would like, you know, his schedule to be able to fit going to EVIT his junior and senior year. And the counselor said to my wife and myself, well, he doesn't have to go to EVIT. He's going to go to college.
Right.
And that is such a misnomer, because the learning that occurs at EVIT is applicable to any student. And I'll tell you why. Oftentimes, students don't have a passion for learning until it becomes contextual, until it becomes hands-on, until it becomes real-life opportunity for them.
Sure.
So for many students, this idea that learning matters only becomes a reality when they come to EVIT. And so when we talk about those students that are going to go to college, their ability to understand why college matters is increased, enhanced by programs like EVIT. For some students, the ability to see that how they're learning and what they're learning is actually a motivator for them to go to college. And the third reason why I think a program like EVIT is for every student is that today's environment and today's workforce is an ever-evolving and ever-changing. And what you might decide is going to be your career path when you're 17 years old may not be your career path when you're 22 years old. Or it may be, but it may not be when you're 30 years old.
Yeah.
And so if you're able to have a passion and a purpose, and that passion and purpose can give you a livable paycheck, that is not a bad thing to have in your pocket, even if you are going to pursue a college degree, right?
So one of the concerns from many CTE advocates is that moving this kind of program out of the Department of Education and into the Department of Labor will essentially undermine its academic rigor, right? Like we'll go back to that kind of old school model. Think about short-term training programs as opposed to long-term education. Do you share those concerns?
I do not, to be honest with you. And the reason why I don't is, and so, you know, I'm the superintendent of EVIT, so of course I'll talk about EVIT. But the EVIT Central Campus program, I mean, one of the things that's most unique about it is the vast majority of our instructors are individuals that did not go through the College of Education.
Sure.
They came from the workforce. And there is something magical about having an individual who has spent his or her career in an industry working with young people to teach that industry. And I say that because I actually think connecting to the Department of Labor, connecting to workforce, connecting to business and industry actually could create a deeper understanding of the industry outcome expectation and knowledge needed. I don't see it reverting back to the days in which it was just a short term. It's for those kids. I actually see it as a potential accelerator and having CTE take a much bigger step forward in its workforce development opportunity by putting it in the Department of Labor, which is ultimately responsible for creating workforce.
Yeah. So there are some silver linings here for you, or even positives.
Yeah, there are. Like I said, I think you know, anytime there's change in legislation or change in statute or change in, you know, where programs are housed, there's reason to be concerned. And so I think it's smart for people to raise those issues and concerns. But I do think that there's much more than a silver lining. I think there's a real golden opportunity potentially for CTE to take a step forward. You know, I shared the story about my son. The reason why, in my opinion, the individual said what he said to my son is because CTE in many ways has been relegated to a second-class citizen in traditional K-12 education. It's a general elective course in many cases.
Sure.
And that isn't what CTE is. And so if it gets pulled out of the DOE and put into the Department of Labor, it may actually take an accelerated step forward on the table of giving students opportunities to not only get credit to complete high school, but also get the industry certification that gives them the leg up or the leg in to the workforce.
Mm. Let me ask you, lastly, a broader question about the Department of Education and the Trump administration's attempt to dismantle it, which is this is part of, obviously held up in court right now. But do you have concerns about that in general and about this sort of being a harbinger for more consolidation?
I think anytime there's a discussion about reducing departments, shifting opportunities, shifting program, there's reason to be concerned because we don't know what that really means, right?
Yeah.
And it's the unknown, I think, that causes some real concern. What I can say, though, is that, you know, I'm the product of K-12 education. I was a high school teacher, a high school assistant principal, high school principal, superintendent of a traditional K-12 education. My dad's an educator. I have cousins and aunts. So I am the K-12 education person.
Yeah.
But I also think that traditional K-12 education in our country and in our state needs a reboot, needs to be rethought to some degree. And if doing that is the result of moving the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, reducing it down, if that produces opportunities that allow us to potentially rethink traditional K-12 education, I don't think that that's a bad thing. And I also think, too, as much as, you know, there's lots of different granting opportunities that come from the federal government. You know, it was just awarded the Build Back America grant that allows us to offer, you know, to be a registered apprenticeship hub. And so we're very grateful for that. But those are federal dollars. And I think there is also value of trying to push more onus and responsibility to K-12 education at the state level. And so in doing so, I think the reduction of the U.S. Department of Education opens the door for that as well, because the unique needs that we have here in Arizona are different than those in Delaware. And I think that matters.
So you like the idea of localizing control of education. Are you concerned, though, about losing that kind of federal funding? We're already seeing a bunch of it frozen right now.
So that's a great question. So I am concerned about it because our system in many ways has been built on that federal funding.
Yeah.
And so unwinding that is not an easy task to do, right? And so I get concerned about the potential of having to unwind that. But I also get encouraged by the same potential of being able to have more direct control at the local level of what we want from our educational system. And so I don't know that there's a bridge that gets from the unwinding of the federal government as it relates to the funds to the autonomy and ownership at the more local level. I don't know what that looks like, but I do think that it's worth trying to look for a bridge that does that, a bridge that allows there to still be federal oversight, because I think federal oversight in some cases does matter, but putting a lot more responsibility, ownership, and support for K-12 education at the local state level so that we can do what's good for our kids here in Arizona, and people in Kentucky can do good things for kids in Kentucky.
All right, we'll leave it there. Dr. Chad Wilson, superintendent of East Valley Institute of Technology, joining us. Yvette, thank you so much, Dr. Wilson, for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why one writer argues it's important for bisexual Americans to fight for LGBTQ+ rights, even if they don't always feel seen. But first,
voters in southern Arizona are heading to the polls this week, deciding who will take the place of the late longtime Arizona Representative Raul Grijalva. And while his own daughter, Adelita Grijalva, is polling ahead, it's another candidate who's making all of the headlines in this race, 25-year-old Deja Fox. The young political upstart is using TikTok and a progressive message to attract attention nationwide. She's what our next guest calls Arizona's own AOC. Phil Boas is a columnist for the Arizona Republic, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, Phil, I want to start with you here. I mean, Deja Fox is not your kind of candidate traditionally on the political spectrum, right? But she seems to have really captured your attention, and you're not the only one. Tell us why.
You know, it's really interesting, but we have this special election in CD7, Southern Arizona, Raul Grijalva's old congressional seat. And the most interesting issue, the big issue, is the winds of change within the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party right now is really in disarray. It's licking its wounds from the presidential contest that it lost. Its polling is at historic lows in voter confidence. It's losing all kinds of support among key demographics, especially with men and Latino men, working class people. So it comes at a time when there's much in flux. And here you have this young candidate in Arizona who really got her first 15 minutes of fame back when she was 16 years old and challenged Jeff Flake at one of his town hall meetings. And she's managed to make that 15 minutes last and has really become an interesting person within the party and somebody worth watching. And I'll just tell you really quickly, what drew my attention to it was something she said in the CD7 debate, and that is, when I was 16, I needed a fighter, so I became one. Mm. And I love that. That was something I wanted to share with my kids. You got to hear what this young person just said, this 25-year-old woman who grew up in poverty.
And she's got quite a story, growing up in poverty in Tucson, Section 8 housing, a single mom, like all of these things. Elvia, do you think that the Democratic Party is ready to listen to somebody like this, somebody who's so young and seemingly different?
No, they're not. And you know what? I am with Phil that I like a fairy tale conceptually. And, you know, she has gotten a lot of attention and she has gotten the attention of Democrats as well. And no, I don't think the Democrats are ready to have someone like her or listen to her. And that's part of the problem that Phil was talking about. You know, in CD7, we have Adelita Grijalva, who is a daughter of the late senator. And the establishment Democratic Party and Democrats usually look at races like that almost as an entitlement. We have seen that in races. We saw that here in Phoenix, like the daughter may be great, but you're not entitled to the seat. So fight it out. Fight it out. And so all the established Democrats are behind Adelita and dismissing this young woman, this candidate. So no, it requires someone like her to shake things up and tell the Democratic Party and any party really, like, if you are not serving us, we will take matters into our own hands. And we know that, I mean, I'm not gonna call her extreme, but we know that people from the far left and the far right usually do great in the primaries, and then they don't do well in the general election. In this case, you know, it is a primary. It is a safe district, though. It's a Democratic district. So whoever wins here might actually take the seat.
Yeah. So let me ask you about some of the substance behind a candidate like this, Phil, right? Like, does this represent more than just style? Like, a lot of the criticism that I've seen of a candidate like Fox is that, yes, like, we might need a new message. Yes, we might need a new face, a younger generation. But is this about substantial change? Does she have the experience to carry this through?
Well, she wouldn't be there if she didn't have some substance. She is very well-spoken, telegenic. She has been involved in politics for 10 years at a very young age. She understands that the coin of the realm today is internet audience, and she has a tremendous following on the internet. She has had articles done on her by, you know, national magazines and also major newspapers. The Washington Post, Newsweek was asking if she's the next AOC. She wouldn't last this long if it were all vapor. It's not. She has real dynamism, and it shows. And it's fun to see new leaders emerging from Gen Z. You know, they're coming along. She's got the backing of David Hogg, another 25-year-old. Mm-hmm. Who's, you know, kind of a dissident within the party, but Gen Z is sort of throwing up their fist and saying, you know, we're coming, you know, we're next. It's time for us, and we're going to make our mark now.
So, Elvia, what do you think about that? I mean, like you said, the Democratic Party establishment has not exactly embraced Fox, but there does seem to be like a reckoning coming for the Democrats. They're in such disarray, like Phil talked about. Do you think that they need to take a page out of this book. They need to at least listen to what this generation has to say in order to move forward.
Yes, and you know what? I was trying not to laugh when Phil was talking, because what experience are people talking about? I mean, she's 25, and she and we're talking about Congress. Has anyone been looking at Congress lately? What are we talking about? Are we talking about business experience, political experience, dealing with congressional folks? You know, oh, come on, it's a total disarray right now. So the kind of experience that you need is essentially dealing with people and connecting with people and making deals. So more importantly here is about the substance of what these candidates are going to do for the district. That's what I would be looking for, not the age, not the experience. And I don't live in that district, but if I did, that's what I will be looking for, you know, regardless of who they are. I mean, are they going to connect? Are they really going to pay attention to, again, the needs of the district versus themselves? And then the other question was, are Democrats going to have a reckoning? They're already having a reckoning, and they should pay attention to how people who counted this like her actually connecting with real people, with a message that resonates with them. That's what they need, and that's what they're suffering from right now.
Phil, where would a candidate like this, should she win, which seems unlikely still at this point, but if a candidate like this should win, like a similar candidate won in New York City, right? Like, where does that take the Democratic Party? Could they compete with a Trump run or even a post-Trump GOP?
Well, the establishment Democrats are fearful that they take them way too far to the left.
Right.
But that seems to be where the energy is in the party right now. And that's where the young people are today. She has the ability to build audience and the potential to build a national following. And that is power. And it's the way the world is today. And she has that kind of potential. Is she going to win? Probably not. But is she the future of the party? I would bet that she is.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Lots to watch for. The election is tomorrow. Phil Boas, columnist for the Arizona Republic, editorial page editor Elvia Diaz, joining us. Thanks to both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. China is hosting a major visit by a regional neighbor this week, and economics and security will both be on the minds of leaders. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones in London. And Rob, what's the significance of Australia's prime minister visiting China?
Well, the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is visiting China for 6 or 7 days, so really quite a long trip. He'll be in Chengdu and in Beijing, and he'll be meeting Xi Jinping, China's leader, and China's premier. So this is really quite a big trip. I should say it's his second since he was re-elected as Australia's Prime Minister in May. And that underlines really the strong trading relationship between China and Australia. For Australia, China is their number one trading nation. So it's very important for them to maintain these strong trading connections. And that's what this trip is largely about. I should say that Australia mines for critical minerals and, earth minerals that we talk so much about, those things that are required for our mobile phones, anything from our mobile phones up to our kind of fighter jets. They mine those quite prodigiously in Australia, as they do in China. But a lot of the refining of those metals, which is required for them to be useful, is actually done in China. In fact, quite a big percentage is done in China. So you can see the sort of dependency that Australia has to some extent on its big neighbor in that part of the world, China. At the same time, Australia is concerned, as so many Western nations are, about the rise of China from a security point of view. The South China Sea, even this week, Taiwan, which China considers to be part of its territory, the island of Taiwan is holding its largest ever military drills, which are designed to kind of send a message to Beijing, don't invade us, basically. Well, Australia would be very much on Taiwan's side in the event of any kind of conflict, as would the United States and many others. And so you can see there's a tension there for Anthony Albanese on this trip to China. On the one hand, he needs to be anxious about China on a security level, but on the other hand, it's a very, very important trading nation for his country. So you can see the tension in that trip, and we'll be watching that.
Interesting. Rob, let's move now to Germany, where this week we'll see a court case that will likely dominate the news there. A doctor in Germany has been charged with the murder of at least 15 patients. What's happening here?
Well, this is a very interesting story and will be front page headlines in Germany today and this week for sure. This man is a 40-year-old palliative care doctor. So in other words, medical care for those with serious illnesses, some of them are incurable. And he is accused, the prosecutors say, he murdered at least 15 of his patients, anything between 25 years old and 94, so not just very old people. He's allegedly killed 12 women and 3 men between September 21 and July 2024, although prosecutors say they believe that total could rise substantially. And there are exhumations going on in Germany to try and ascertain whether other people have been the victim of this man or not. He's said to have plied his patients with a cocktail of lethal drugs, anesthetics, and muscle relaxants, applied to his patients without their knowledge or consent. Now, this case is very big. He's only being identified, by the way, as Johannes M. That's all they're saying about his name, and that's because the privacy laws in Germany are really very strong. So I think we're going to find out a lot more about this guy, what prosecution says, what his lawyers say. But this will certainly be a really interesting case in Germany, one of the biggest of its kind in that nation.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. So, Rob, let's stick in Germany for just a moment, where the issue of migration will feature highly in Europe this coming week. Germany is holding an international conference on this. Britain and France have just announced a significant migration deal. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, so Germany this week on Friday, European interior ministers will be invited to Germany, to Germany's highest mountain, actually, which is where this is taking place, probably for a security point of view. They're inviting delegates from France, Poland, Austria, Denmark, the Czech Republic, and others. And that sort of underlines why or how migration is such a big issue around the world, of course, but it certainly is in Europe as well. In fact, I was hearing an interview with a Polish minister just the other day, in which he was touting how good the fence was that Poland has built along its border to keep out illegal migrants. You know, this is a big issue for many, many European countries. It comes as Britain, here in Britain, we have just had a state visit from the French leader, Emmanuel Macron. At the end of that, there was a press conference, and the number one subject discussed in that press conference was the people who are coming across the English Channel between England and France, the many thousands of people that come every year, and many of those people are illegal migrants, and Britain has a problem in terms of what do they do with these people, how do they process them, and so on. And this has been an ongoing, raging debate in Britain because people worry about the effect that too many illegal migrants have on, you know, public services and other things in this country. And in fact, it was one of the driving forces behind Brexit, behind Britain leaving the European Union. So this was a big press conference, and they discussed migration, and they've come up with a plan, or at least they think will be an effective plan, in which the French will take more people back on its side, and the British will be able to push more people back, if you like, to continental Europe. So they were touting this as a big deal. We will see the details of that this week and be able to make a judgment.
All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones in London. Rob, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Yes. Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. It has been a treacherous year for trans people, between the Supreme Court empowering states to block gender-affirming care and the Trump administration taking various steps to deny the existence of trans identities. Many LGBTQ plus folks are feeling anxious about their safety. But for those who feel moved to speak out or protest, there's also a palpable sense of fear about being targeted. With that in mind, Sam Perry has a modest proposal. Maybe it's time for the bisexuals to step up. Perry is a writer and an ASU graduate, and she recently wrote an opinion essay for The Advocate called "We're the Biggest Queer Group You Never See. It's Time We Change That." Perry spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman, and they started with why Perry thinks the B in LGBTQ+ is the group we hear from the least.
I think bisexuality as a term is a little bit more ambiguous maybe than other parts of the acronym. Mm-hmm. I think people understand what gay is and understand what lesbian is, but and now they're understanding what trans is. But the B and also the Q, I think, are just a little bit harder for people to grasp, especially if someone is not bisexual.
What for you has been your experience with, I mean, you were just alluding to it a bit, but the politicization around queer identity and the compulsion that I know some queer people feel to be a part of the fight for equal rights and visibility and things of this nature.
Yeah, I think if someone is gay or if someone is trans, I feel like their identity is a little bit more inherently politicized because those are the terms that people recognize. Mm-hmm. I think with bisexuality, it's interesting because there's almost this choice to opt in or out that I feel like gay and trans people don't get quite as much because people don't necessarily see bisexuality as real or as a valid identity. It's almost like it's a little bit more of a conscious choice that one has to make if they want to politicize their own identity, if they want to make it a point to let people know that they're bisexual. And that was what really inspired me to write the piece.
Is it difficult as a bisexual person to align yourself with other queer groups that do experience being targeted more for the reasons you were just pointing out?
For me personally, I think that it is. I think queer groups in it as a whole are generally accepting. I think sometimes bisexual people don't know if they quite fit into the queer identity, especially depending on what your concept of bisexuality is. Like, people get very hung up on percentages or who you're dating and things like that. Obviously, if you're in a same sex or same gender relationship, you appear to the public perhaps as gay anyway, even if you are bisexual. So it might be a little bit easier to be in those spaces. If you're a bisexual person that's single or that's in a straight passing relationship, it might feel a little strange. It's kind of a dance, and it's almost like your identity is invisible, and you obviously don't want to go around just saying I'm bisexual over and over. But it's kind of hard because it's you can't expect people to be able to tell, right, whether you're straight or whether you're bi.
Right. I've seen some numbers where, you know, for all of the conversation in the news at the moment about trans and non-binary folks, that is something like 1.6% of American adults. So obviously an extreme minority. Meanwhile, 4% of adults identify as bisexual. Obviously, you know, assigning numbers to this is always going to be a little bit tricky. But that's still a very small number in the context of the broader American population, but within the community, it is much bigger.
The percentages are always interesting, and this is why I bring it up. the way I see it is because currently trans and non-binary stand out as the most different, right, from perhaps what the masses would think is normal, I do think that's why the spotlight is on them at this point in time. Mm-hmm. It's also partially giving them their flowers for their role in the queer community, right? So I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, unfortunately, in that regard.
Right. There's a hyper-focus there that they may not even have asked for.
Right. Yeah. And it could be used for good and for bad. Mm-hmm. And I think bisexuals almost have the opposite problem where we're kind of the silent majority and there's so many of us and yet no one ever really talks about what it means to really be a bisexual person. So to me, I almost view it as opposite problems compared to the trans and the non-binary identities right now.
So this brings us in some ways to the piece that you wrote for The Advocate, where you're calling on fellow bisexual folks to step forward a bit, step out of some of the invisibility and uncertainty that we've been talking about. Why do you think this is the moment for that to happen?
unfortunately, we're seeing such a spotlight on queer people in general. You know, like I mentioned, trans and non-binary might be kind of the focus of the ire right now.
Yeah.
I just want to caution queer people as a whole that just because the spotlight is directed on one part of the community doesn't mean that spotlight can't broaden. Mm-hmm. And I think it also, you know, if we are acting as a community, if you consider yourself part of the community, we kind of have a responsibility to uplift perhaps the less powerful members of our community and to really stand by them.
Well, what are some advantages you think bisexual people in particular have in stepping forward and joining the fight if they feel safe to do that?
It really depends. So a lot of bisexual people are in straight passing relationships, and a lot of bisexual people are actually overly closeted. So some bisexual people are out to nobody, not to their family, sometimes not even to their partner, not at work. Because if you don't have to come out, if you're in a straight passing relationship, it's a little bit easy to let everyone just think that you're straight and to just never bring it up. So in that sense, there are a lot of bisexual people out there who experience a lot of the privileges that straight people have. But internally, you know, they may know that they're queer. So I think there is sort of an invisibility that can be used for good or can be used to elevate less powerful people in society.
This is really interesting, Sam, I have to say, because I feel like you're talking about if you are someone who is not as queer presenting, but know for yourself, whether that's just you and yourself or you in a small circle of people, that you are queer, there is a privilege associated with the fact that people who might have negative opinions towards queer people might not know that you are one, and that puts you in a position to start conversations, get involved in actions, that sort of thing.
Yes, I think that's totally possible. And I think you can still be helpful to yourself and to others without ever having to reveal that.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about the, and again, I know I'm using probably a clumsy phrase here, but let's talk about the in-group dynamics of this, because it sounds like you're also saying that this is a moment where bisexual people who may sometimes struggle to find community amongst other queer people, or maybe just have not felt as compelled to try to find that community, ought to get a little bit more internally organized and see what might come out of building those communities out a bit more.
Yes, I would love for bisexuals to get organized because we have the numbers, right? Like that blows right. My mind. I'm like, we've got the numbers. If anything, there should be way more bisexual people in these spaces because there just are more of us according to the stats, which again, who knows how true and accurate those stats are.
Right.
People change all the time how they identify. But yes, I mean, if being bisexual is the only queer thing about you or the only politically other thing about you, I can understand why people don't necessarily embrace it or they don't think of it as a big deal. And I'm definitely challenging those people to reconsider. You know, when the other is under attack or when a spotlight is put on the other, it's just very good to understand how you fit into that dynamic and to understand how people see you. I think this is also a chance for those people who want to be more engaged to get together to either form their own group or to become a more prominent part of the groups that already exist, because there are many, many queer groups that are already doing the work. And so just feel emboldened to be a part of these groups and to learn about the queer community that is around you and to really embrace that part of themselves.
All right. Well, Sam Perry is the author of the piece, We're the Biggest Queer Group You Never See. It's Time We Change That, which recently appeared in The Advocate. Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Apparently, when you ask folks to tell you stories about a time they misbehaved, there's a good chance you'll get a tale involving high school and driving. That happened last week when Phoenix storyteller Dan Hull recalled a memorable New Year's Eve for our latest series of soapbox essays. We've got another today, and we'll let Amanda Kerberg tell you the rest.
I know a weird number of college professors who had truancy issues in high school. We wanted to stay in school forever, just not that school. Once we hit college, we said, lock me in, I'm never leaving. College isn't designed to lock you in. High school is. Universities are built like the estates of old world aristocrats captured in revolution and repurposed to educate the masses. We wander freely up their spiral staircases and pull books from their library shelves and tread on their tennis courts. In cities like Bologna and Prague, palace buildings serve as lecture halls. In New York City, the largest private landowner is Columbia University. High schools are built like panopticons, the hulking surveillance state that holds the revolution at bay. Today, security continues to tighten while digital technology creates new kinds of absence. The windowless architecture can obscure the sky, but it can't keep out the blue light of smartphones. We didn't have smartphones in the early 2000s. My little Nokia flip phone could make calls and play Snake, and that was it. One time I called my mom when I realized I was wearing two different shoes. She said no one would notice. My means of escape was much more old school, a press pass. I'd been on the school paper since I was a little freshman, when my first in-depth investigation proved that we were actually in class a full week longer every year than our rival school up the hill. And considering their higher test scores and better football team, I reasoned that that time was not only superfluous, but possibly detrimental. My report changed nothing, but after that, the principal always knew my name. High school post-Columbine meant ID checks and restricted movement, but if you had a press pass dangling on a maroon lanyard, you could leave class. And if you had a press pass and a car, you could leave school. By my senior year, I was making up for those weeks of extra class time. My friend Dora and I would flash our press passes and head out to lunch or walk around the mall. This was back when coffee was still for office workers and not the sugar bomb mecca of teenagers. Dora had this adorable face that could get away with anything. And at 17, I had the withered eye bags of a 40-year-old, so we never looked delinquent. Neither of us was ever good at being bad. We had all the menace of two kids on their first day of Rumspringa, giggling as we pressed elevator buttons for floors we weren't going to. On one carefree afternoon, we were just cresting a rise past Blockbuster Video when I recognized a familiar silhouette. A black and white 93 Oldsmobile minivan coming right toward me with my mom at the helm. "Duck," I said. Dora yelped and crouched down in the passenger seat. And then, for some reason, I also ducked. And that's how, more than 20 years before Waymo's hit the valley, my mom watched a 1997 beige Nissan Altima miraculously drive itself down Warner Road. In my pocket, my Nokia flip phone started to ring.
That was Phoenix-based writer Amanda Kerberg, who often joins us on the show to talk about pop culture. You can hear her essay and others from our Soapbox collections at kjzz.org/soapbox. And be sure to check out the instructions for how you might get your own story on the radio.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.